Hello, I'm Cal Tilio. This is number 0455, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0455. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, actor-musician Robbie Rist, who is someone I have a lot of time for. He's a friend of the show. He's also been an actor since he was a kid. How did it begin for him?
According to the history, I kind of complained my parents into it. I, as a youngster, was obsessed with the 1930s Universal horror films. So anyway, I told my parents I wanted to be in a monster movie, and then I said I want to be in a monster movie again, and then I said I want to be in a monster movie again. And then eventually it became I want to be in a movie, and my parents went, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take him on a cattle call, and he's going to see how awful this all is, and he's not going to want to do it. Boom, we're off the hook. And I got the job.
Ernie Smith from the newsletter Tedium, the dull side of the internet, is back on the show, this time to talk about his recent piece on the history of e-readers.
It's really fascinating because one of the things I mentioned in the piece is that quite often we have a tendency to like sort of forget about the history of something once there's like a quote-unquote category killer. So like when the Kindle came out, people kind of forgot that there was many decades of history that predated this where people were trying to make ebooks and e-readers a thing.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. Book Banter goes back to those happy days with Mrs. C herself, Marion Ross, and her new memoir, My Days, Happy and Otherwise. So sit on it and give it a listen later on the Stuff File program.
And of course, there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0455, was Carl Thériault, the media and public relations person from the Montreal Jewish General Hospital. Now, I'm the host, as you may know, of the English version of the Your Health podcast, and Carl is the host of the new French version, which will begin starting May the 10th. So welcome aboard. This is going to be a fun ride, Carl. And thanks for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? According to police in Florida, a man who became angry with his boyfriend grabbed a singing toy fish and used it to assault his partner. Police said that they have arrested 54-year-old Gregory Carney after being accused of using a big-mouth Billy Bass to beat his boyfriend, Larry Timmerman. According to the police investigation, Carney and Timmerman lived together for 17 years. On Sunday, the couple had been arguing all day. At some point, Timmerman took the big mouth Billy Bass and threw it in the garbage can. When Carney asked where the singing toy fish was, Timmerman told him to look in the trash can. Carney then flew into a rage. He took the singing fish out of the trash and threw it at Timmerman, and as a result, Timmerman suffered a laceration to the head. In other words, a pain from the bass. Carney has been charged with one count of battery domestic violence. You know, one of the songs Big Mouth Billy Bass is known for singing is "Don't Worry, Be Happy." How ironic. I guess the honeymoon's over here. After 17 years, on a scale of 1 to 10, let's just say this relationship is doomed. And by the way, something scaly was used. Meanwhile, a team of Australian scientists said that they were really miserable to discover the world's oldest known spider was killed by a wasp sting at the age of 43. Leander Mason of Curtin University said the female trapdoor spider, known as number 16, was 43 years old when it was killed by a wasp sting at its burrow in the wild. The previous record holder for oldest spider was a 28-year-old Mexican tarantula documented by researchers. Female trapdoor spiders tend to remain in the areas around their burrows for their entire lives, allowing number 16 to be studied in the wild. To our knowledge, this is the oldest spider ever recorded, and her significant life has allowed us to further investigate the trapdoor spider's behavior and popular dynamics, Mason said in a Curtin University news release. Number 16 was born in 1974. Okay, here's what I want to know. In the 43 years that they had this spider, don't you think someone could have given the thing a name? I mean, it's like that song by America, you know, A Horse with No Name. Right there in the lyrics, they say, "I've been through the desert on a horse with no name." Pal, you're out there for days. Name the damn horse already. Yeah. A Vermont man is facing charges that he used a shotgun to silence a smoke detector in the kitchen of his apartment. Police say two shots were fired one afternoon from the 20-gauge shotgun owned by 68-year-old Leroy Mason of Barton, hitting the adjoining wall of an occupied apartment. Police say Mason had complained about frequent false alarms from his smoke detector, and he was also upset that the fire crews wouldn't relocate it, so he took it upon himself to relocate the smoke detector and shot it with a shotgun. Emergency personnel say they took the shotgun from Mason, who then pointed a handgun at them while demanding his shotgun back. Emergency crews disarmed Mason. There were no injuries. Mason pleaded not guilty and was released. You know, irony would have been if his shotgun blast started a fire. But in all seriousness, if this is a standard store-bought, battery-operated type smoke detector, couldn't Mason simply get a screwdriver and relocate the detector someplace else in his kitchen, away from his stove? I mean, that's a lot easier than blowing a hole in your ceiling with a shotgun, don't you think? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, many a man has been accused of loving cars too much, but this next story takes it to a higher level. Police in Newton, Kansas, took a 24-year-old man to the emergency room on May the 1st after he was found attempting to have sex with a car. According to Lieutenant Scott Powell of the Newton Police Department, we were called to the 1200 block of East Broadway to a report of a naked male underneath a car. He was attempting to stick his penis into the tailpipe of the vehicle. According to Powell, the suspect did not respond to officers' commands, and officers used a taser to subdue him. He was high on some sort of drug, Powell said. Officers were there, and he continued to try and have sex with the tailpipe of the car. He would not listen to commands or anything. The man, who will likely be charged with a misdemeanor of lewd and lascivious behavior, was intoxicated to the point he was nearly incoherent. He was so impaired we could not take him to jail, Powell said. He was taken to the emergency room as the result of his odd behavior due to a 0.35 blood alcohol level and possible drug use. Officers also observed what appeared to be a head injury previous to interaction with the officers. Okay, you think this story is complete, right? But I've got one burning question. I'm sure he has a burning question too, but that's another story. What model of car was he making out with? I've searched for several sources to this story, and none of them coughs up that vital detail. Also, was the motor running? And does he have a thing for all pipes? For instance, how does he feel about sinks? Just asking. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Actor-musician Robbie Rist is back on the show. The last couple of times we spoke about his involvement in the world of Sharknado, but this time around, we just want to talk about all things Robbie. So, he joins us on the line via Skype from California. Hi, Robbie.
Peter, you can lie, okay? But am I your go-to American?
You're always my go-to American, just like I seem to be your go-to Canadian on your show, The Spoon, which I've had the pleasure of being on several times.
Yes, yes, you're always a great guest. You know, it's one of those things, we talked about this on the phone yesterday, but, you know, when I get to talking to you, it's sort of like, oh my gosh, you know, like an hour has passed and it felt like a minute. It's amazing.
Exactly, exactly. But I wanted to talk to you about your acting career and all the work you've been doing as a musician. I say actor, musician, because people, when they, you know, your name is out there in the vernacular and they know only a few things, and there's so many things you do.
Yeah, I think after I die, there's going to be like some sort of retrospective where they're like, really, he did that too? You know, and nobody knew that. I forget who it is. There was a 40s era actress who, you know, invented radio waves or something. Hedy Lamarr, maybe.
Hedy Lamarr. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you know, and nobody really knew about that until like recently. So that's how it's going to be with me. I know my place in the pantheon.
And right now, I mean, I haven't mentioned that iconic role, but if I say right now, Cousin Oliver, there's somebody out there who's going to say, oh, that guy.
Oh, that guy. Yeah, I love being an oh, that guy. All of my favorite actors are oh, that guys. Actually, all of my favorite musicians are oh, that guys also. Whenever I see a big actor in a movie, I find it hard to get into because I'm just aware of the fact that I'm looking at this guy that I've seen do this before.
Mm. What would be the thing that you could say to the general population about those who know Robbie Rist that would surprise them? What's in your resume that's a surprise to people?
Huh? Oh, gosh. I don't think anything, because I don't know if you've ever been by my Facebook page or my Twitter. You know, I kind of leave it all up there on the stage. So I, what is the surprise? Anything. Let's see. I had a vitamin D deficiency as a child. Let's see. What else? I don't know. I had my first colonoscopy at 54.
I saw that on Facebook.
See, that's exactly what that. I'm saying.
Wow. You do leave it all out there. So, again, you how old were you when you first started in the business?
Well, I think the first audition was like sort of in like before almost seven.
Seven.
Yeah. And according to the history, I kind of complained my parents into it. So I, as a youngster, was obsessed with the 1930s Universal horror films.
Right.
You know, Karloff and Lugosi and all that. And actually, my favorite of all of them was the Wolfman. For some reason, something about the Wolfman character really touched me to this day. There's a melancholy to the whole thing that really, even at like four, I was like, oh man, I totally get this. Hilarious. So anyway, I told my parents I wanted to be in a monster movie, and then I said I want to be in a monster movie again, and then I said I want to be in a monster movie again, and then eventually it became I want to be in a movie, and my parents went, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take him on a cattle call, and he's going to see how awful this all is, and he's not going to want to do it. Boom, we're off the hook. And I got the job.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So after I got that one, I said, I really enjoyed doing that thing. Can we do this again? And then they were rolled their eyes and went, bit the bullet, took me on my second audition, and I got that one. And then I was about six or seven that I'd gotten in a row before I didn't get one. And all that did was steal my resolve. I went, what are you talking about? You don't get everyone. Really? Watch this. And then, like, I think I did, like, I don't know. I did close to 200 commercials in 3 years. I mean, I was like, when I was a kid, I was cranking. And then, I continued to work. I still do to this day. So I guess I really knew what I wanted to do at a really early age.
Since the impetus was from those early Universal horror films, how do you feel about the fact that Universal wants to reboot them all?
It's a property, I guess. I mean, none of them have been any good yet. So they did a Mummy movie. And they did a werewolf movie. So I don't know. You know, maybe it's sort of like, you know, it took him a while to really understand that making comic books and making comic book movies were two separate things. And so they've really figured out how to make comic book movies now. Maybe they'll find a way to sort of revive this sort of gothic style of really not scary horror. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Is there anything in your career that you really, really wanted and you haven't had a chance to do yet, or an opportunity that you didn't get that you really had wanted to do?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's a lot of things I wanted to do. And actually, you know, one of the things, you know, kid actors have varying opinions about their experiences in entertainment. And my own experiences, I wouldn't trade it for the world, because I've seen a lot of incredible things, and I think I've learned things that maybe people of my generation, or just everybody born around the same time as me or whatever, just stuff that, you know, they never learned. Little wisdom things, like, you know, this wanting jobs really bad, and early on going, God, I was so good, why didn't I get that one? And what it kind of taught me is sort of a Zen kind of thing of not wanting anything too badly. It's a thing. You know, there will be other things. So, it's really helped me with disappointment, which is something that everybody has in their lives.
You brought the word Zen, and I tend to think of you as a bit of an oxymoron, because I find you to be...
What did you call me? Yes, sir.
I find you to be the Zen grumpy guy.
Yeah, totally. Sure. Well, you know, there are... just because I'm aware of my place in the universe doesn't mean I don't look at the universe sometimes and go, are you kidding me with this? So... Yeah, I guess Zen Grumpy Guy. Maybe I should change my little headline on Twitter.
No, Zen. How about this? Zen Curmudgeon. There you go.
The Zen Curmudgeon. I love it. Guess what? That blog's happening.
For those who haven't followed you on Facebook, and everyone should, you're not always there. You have been...
It's not that I'm not always there. I go to jail a lot.
Yeah, I was about to say, they give you a timeout on Facebook every once in a while.
Yeah, yeah. For, you know, making somebody... I mean, the thing is, I make everything I say public because, you know, I'm on a very tiny level, I'm something of a public figure. So...
I think you're being modest with that, though. You are a public figure. People know who Robbie Rist is.
Well, I don't know. But yeah, okay, if they do. But, you know, it's a very small... Again, I know my place in the universe. However, you know, every once in a while, somebody who knows me from TV and wants to be my friend is all of a sudden offended, you know, when I say, isn't this photo of you at that Klan rally? You know, so... You know, and then they're all mad at me, and then they turn me into Facebook and like 30-day timeout. You know, all right, that's fine. I mean, you know, somebody has to take the hit for truth. Ask Jesus.
Have you become, you know, the world has become a little meaner since the last election that you guys had. Have you found that you have become... a little more caustic since the current administration?
No. I mean, I've always been kind of a caustic guy. I mean, I've actually, though, I've never been this concerned. I've never been this concerned that somebody who's run, you know, I wasn't the biggest George W. Bush fan on the planet, but mostly what I said was he's a dumb person. You know, this goes beyond just a dumb person. This is a very dangerous dumb person. And I'm not sure, you know, I mean, he's really just in it for himself. And it's other people in America see that as leading.
Yeah. I like to be optimistic and think that America is a country that's too strong to be broken down in a way that some people think it's going to be, and that this, in the grand scheme of things, is just a palate cleanser.
Well, maybe. Two things. First, Winston Churchill said that America always does the right thing when they've tried everything else. And then the other thing is, we're a little over 200 years old, and we've only had one civil war. Now, I hope it does not ever happen. I'm the whole notion of us solving an issue by shooting hot pieces of lead at each other is to me the very definition of stupidity. However, it seems like, ask China. You know, civil wars are kind of a thing that new countries do. And it sure is getting tense out there, and I sure hope it doesn't happen, but we have only had one.
Well, on that happy note, we've run out of time.
There's your Zen curmudgeon for you.
We've run out of time, but I've got to get in there. Whatever it is that you want to plug that you're doing right now. What's Robbie Rist doing right now?
Robbie Rist is working on songs for Sharknado 6. He's actually going to make an appearance in it. I'm, doing a lot of mundane, BS stuff. Like, I'm trying to get a comprehensive website put up. I've recently gotten my Bandcamp site, where it looks like less like somebody kind of went, oh, why don't we just put this stuff in the closet and actually put a little work into it. So I'm doing that. I'm producing, a couple of people. I'm teaching some acting. Doc McStuffins is coming to a close, so I got to, I got to get busy and find some other thing to do. Just what I always do. Just like a little of this, a little of that, a little soda down your pants.
I just believe there's a bit of an exclusive there. When you mentioned you're going to be in the next Sharknado, weren't you killed in the first one?
Ooh. That's all I'll say.
Okay. Robbie, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being
here with us.
Thank you,
sir. It's delightful.
Actor-musician Robbie Rist. Check out the podcast, The Spoon. You'll find it at thespoonradio.com. That show is a lot of fun. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0455, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Ernie Smith from Tedium about the history of e-readers. Plus, Stuart Nellman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, police in New Jersey said a mystery pooper responsible for repeatedly leaving human feces on a high school's field was identified as a nearby school superintendent. The Homedale Township Police Department said Homedale High School staff were finding fresh piles of poop on a daily basis in the area surrounding the facility's football and track fields. The school resource officer and school staff monitored the area and identified the mystery pooper as 42-year-old Thomas Tremaglini of Mattawan. Tremaglini is the school superintendent of the Kenilworth School District, which does not include Homedale High School. According to officials, we learned of municipal court charges facing our current superintendent of schools in Homedale, New Jersey. Given the nature of those charges, he asked for and was granted a paid leave of absence. Tremaglini faces charges of defecating in public, lewdness, and littering, police say. You know, a school superintendent is supposed to be a role model for the kids. This guy's on a paid leave of absence, which means he's expecting to come back to work. What are the chances that when he returns, he'll find that his entire office has been TP'd by the kids? Oh, I'm sure they could do worse. Yeah. And while we're on the topic of excrement, Kim Jong-un is the first leader of North Korea to visit South Korea since the end, or at least the ceasefire, of the Korean War in 1953. But one thing the Supreme Leader, currently thought to be around 34 years old, won't do is sit on a foreign toilet. Rather than using a public restroom, the leader of North Korea has a personal toilet that follows him around when he travels. This according to Lee Yoon-kol, a former member of a North Korean Guard Command unit before he left for South Korea in 2005. The leader's excretions contain information about his health status, so they can't be left behind. Wow. So now you know what they meant when South Korean officials said that they would take no crap from Kim Jong-un. You know, this level of paranoia has got to earn Hall of Fame status. I mean, seriously. On April 23rd, police officers in Warren, Michigan, responded to a home for a welfare check on 68-year-old George Curtis, whose relatives had been concerned because they hadn't heard from him. Curtis was indeed dead. In fact, he had been deceased for months, maybe even a year. Also in the home, his girlfriend, who had continued living there with his decaying body, which was laid out in a bed. Police transported the unnamed woman to a hospital for a mental examination and are awaiting a report on the cause of death from the medical examiner. You know, even in a marriage, they say, till death do us part. That should have been a bit of a hint to the girlfriend who is now getting a checkup from the neck up. Meanwhile, on the south side of Chicago, police responded to reports of an elderly woman pushing a dead body around the Chatham neighborhood in a shopping cart on April 21st. Officers took the woman to a hospital for a mental evaluation and launched an investigation into the female body whose age and identity had not been determined at press time. Well, maybe this woman and the girlfriend from the previous story are Monty Python fans.
Bring out your dead! Bring out your dead! Bring out your dead!
Yep, those were simpler times. And finally in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Omar Austin of Jacksonville, Florida, was upset when he saw the question on his daughter's anatomy assignment at Westside High School. The question starts with, Ursula was angry after her boyfriend broke up with her after having sex. It goes on to say, to get revenge, she had sex with his best friend the next day. The question gives the blood types of Ursula, the boyfriend, and his best friend, and asks students to figure out what the resulting baby's blood type could be, assuming the X is the baby daddy. In a statement, the school district said that it would, quote, take appropriate and corrective action. Right. I'm assuming that includes providing students with free condoms. And you know, we've come a long way from the type of questions we had in school back in the day. Remember the simple, Farmer Brown has an apple tree with 25 apples on it. If his neighbor takes 13 apples, what does Farmer Brown have left? Yeah, simpler times. By the way, the answer to that question of what does Farmer Brown have left? That's easy. 25 apples and a dead neighbor. Okay, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program. Ernie Smith, the man behind the website and newsletter known as Tedium, which is subtitled The Dull Side of the Internet, is back on the program. The last time we talked on the show, we discussed the history of the straw. This time around, he's here to talk about a recent newsletter that took a look at the history of e-readers. Ernie joins us on the line via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Nice to have you back on the program again. Just as a coincidence, just on our last program, we spoke to somebody who has a company in Cambodia. We spoke to her in Cambodia. They make bamboo straws, reusable straws, talking about the problem of the waste that plastic straws have. So here we are talking about something else this time around, having last time talked about the straw. So it's all serendipity. E-readers, this is something that I adore. I have a Kindle. I'm on my second Kindle. I just basically burned my first one out after about 8 years. I love my e-reader, and one of your recent Tedium newsletters talks about the history of the news or the e-reader. What did you find out?
Well, you know, it's really fascinating because I think that one of the things I mentioned in the piece is that quite often we have a tendency to sort of forget about the history of something once there's like a quote unquote category killer. So like when the Kindle came out, people kind of forgot that there was like many decades of history that predated this where people were trying to make ebooks and e-readers a thing. And I think that, and there's evidence that people were trying to do things somewhat similar to this for decades. There's one example that goes all the way back to the 1940s.
That's the one where you have a picture of a woman who is the Spanish teacher.
She's a teacher from Spain, and she had come up with this. She had come up with this device that effectively was the Encyclopedia Mechanica, or the Mechanical Encyclopedia. And certainly it doesn't compare exactly to the Kindle today, but it had a lot of similar approaches in that it was designed to be something that was very portable, that for students that could take reading material home rather than a number of heavy books. And the way that it actually did this was through the use of a series of spindles. Basically, the information written on these spindles or illustrated on these spindles would come across horizontally rather than vertically, or rather than, you know, obviously there wasn't really a lot of touch functionality with something like this because it predated computers. But it was very much was, you know, ahead of its time, but it was also very forgotten in its time. It just sort of, you know, it was this idea that never went beyond the prototype stage.
And it was also more mechanical in nature. So let's flash forward to some of the ones that came out before the Kindle as we know it. As you say, the Kindle kind of basically wiped out a lot of its predecessors by being the robust unit that it is. What are some of the things that came along in more modern times that you can definitely see the generational connection to what we now see as e-readers?
I think one of the best examples of this is something that Sony came out with in the early 90s called the Data Discman. It kind of, I guess a good way to describe it is that it had an LCD screen and it kind of looks like an oversized Game Boy, but it was designed so that you could basically put in miniature CDs with reading materials on them. And then you would be able to actually kind of scroll through them. It was somewhat popular in Japan, but outside of that, it was really niche. Slightly more popular, and probably something you actually might have run into back in the 90s, was something called the Franklin Bookman. Franklin was this electronics manufacturer that had a lot of trouble in the 80s. It got sued by Apple and such. And then it pivoted to sort of these simple handheld devices such as the Spelling Ace and such. And by the mid-90s, they had come up with a device that was – it wasn't designed to like allow you to read like really long books. It was often reference materials such as, you know, such as translation programs, dictionaries, small encyclopedias. And it was something that they had like built this large niche onto. In terms of things that came about later that really started to show a shape that was much closer to what we know today to be an e-reader. Right around 98 and 99, there were two competing technologies, one called the Softbook Reader and the other called the Nuvo Media Rocket eBook. And both of these had a shape that was very much large screen, black and white. They used LCD rather than the modern, like, e-ink that everybody's familiar with. They had somewhat limited battery life. They had somewhat limited support. They weren't really like very popular in their day. But the result of this is that they were very formative in terms of what the ebook eventually became.
Now, did you find in doing your research, was there any connection between any of these readers and, say, publishing companies? Because there's two trains of thought when we think of early e-readers. Either they were embraced by publishers who saw the wave of the future, or they were feared by publishers who saw them being put out of business as far as, you know, dead tree versions are concerned.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of that. But in the case of the Softbook Reader, that actually did have support from Random House and Simon & Schuster. They supported the company, but eventually they kind of gave up on it and they sold it off to this other company called Gemstar, which if you used a VCR back in the 90s, they created the technology behind VCR Plus, which was kind of their big thing. So, you know,
if I'm not mistaken, Gemstar also made one of the first TV converters.
They probably did. They had quite the history. I mean, for a time, they actually owned TV Guide, the magazine, and they had like this very specific like technological niche tied to the TV set. But then, you know, they tried to get into the e-reader market, and obviously, you know, since we're all using Gemstar e-readers these days, it totally worked out for them.
As we say, the Kindle is the granddaddy of the market nowadays. It's also become basically a verb, but it's not the only one out there.
Yeah, and there was actually an example of an e-ink e-reader that predated the Kindle by about 4 years. It was called the Sony Liberi. Sony apparently they kept trying to like make the e-book happen, and along with a lot of other things during this era. And it actually looks a lot like the original Kindle did. It came out originally in the Japanese market. It had a keyboard at the bottom. But it also had a lot of stuff that Sony was criticized for during this period. Like, they tended to lock down a lot of their stuff with digital rights management, for example.
It also had four AA batteries, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Like, this was, a lot of these devices didn't necessarily use lithium ion that apparently came later.
What do you have? Because like I said, I'm a Kindle evangelist. I love mine. I don't go anywhere without it. I've read more since I've first started using a Kindle as an adult than I did in all the years between going to college and being and having a Kindle. I'm a voracious reader, which is something I was never before as far as leisure reading is concerned. So it has changed my reading habits. How about you?
I found them to be appealing to some degree, although I admit that, like, I kind of, you know, when I do curl up with a book, it's usually either it's usually either on a tablet or in a dead tree form. You know, I guess it must be a neophyte or something.
But it's neophyte or not, it's always interesting to read what you write on Tedium each and every week. They're fun reads indeed, no matter what platform you're reading it on. Ernie, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Ernie Smith, writer of the website and newsletter Tedium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0455, and you'll find links to Ernie's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you ever thrown out a small check that you got in the mail for a class action lawsuit? If so, this segment is for you. According to a report I read recently, hundreds of millions of dollars in class action settlements go unclaimed each year. There are many reasons for this, but one of the most common is that when people think a lawsuit is frivolous, they don't want to accept money they think was unfairly taken from someone else. That's a noble position, but a lawyer who fights frivolous lawsuits recently told me something surprising. He said, "It's better to cash the check." Let's be fair, that doesn't sound right, but he says it's better to take the money and give it to a charity of your choice than not to claim it. The reason? Unclaimed money usually doesn't go back to the person or the company who was sued. Instead, it often goes to a pet cause of the lawyers who filed the lawsuit. It may even include the law school where they got their degree. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, here he is. You know him, you love him, you can't read without him. Time to crack a spine with Stuart Nolman. Hi, Stu.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Fine. you having digestive problems? What was happening there?
No, but if you would have seen me, I had my thumbs up too and wearing my leather jacket. I'm just recalling Happy Days.
Oh, I thought I thought you were into some strange kind of cosplay thing going on. I didn't want to interrupt something. Okay.
Well, you know, it would have been too obvious if I went Sunday, Monday, Happy Days. I thought maybe give you a little element of surprise there.
Okay. I'm surprised.
You're surprised.
Yes.
Okay. Well, it worked.
Yes, it did.
Well, on this edition of Book Banter, I'm going to review a book regarding Happy Days, but by one of its cast members. Because, you know, for fans of classic television shows, if they ever decided to create a Hall of Fame for the tube's greatest moms, the following names would automatically come to mind: Harriet Nelson, June Cleaver, Carol Brady, Shirley Partridge, and, of course, Marion Cunningham. And they wouldn't be immortalized for how they looked so fashionable in an apron and high heels, or how they kept their TV families well-fed with milk and cookies or meatloaf and mashed potatoes, but how, in their own right, managed to keep their respective family dynamics intact with plenty of humor, wisdom, and strength. Now, although many people remember Marion Ross for her role as Mrs. C on the ABC hit sitcom Happy Days throughout its decade-long run from 1974 to 1984, her book, called My Days, Happy and Otherwise, shows that her life, both professional and personal, wasn't always idyllic as that of the life of the fictional Cunningham family of Milwaukee.
You know, we had her on the show a couple of weeks ago. A little over a month ago, actually, and she's an absolutely delightful person to talk to. I'm sure you found this the same when you had a chance to talk to her as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, I could have spent another half an hour just chatting about the show and some of the moments. She was surprised I knew quite a lot about the history of the show, actually. So, yeah, it was a great interview, which you'll read in the Montreal Times. But Marion was born October of 1928 in the small Minnesota town of Albert Lea And she told me her mother was actually a Canadian. She was born and raised in northern Saskatchewan. But Marion knew from an early age that a career as an actress, particularly a Broadway actress, was destined for her. And ironically, when her family moved to California, she began to get small roles in a variety of movies and TV shows like Perry Mason, General Electric Theater, The Untouchables, Rawhide, and starring with such greats as Clark Gable, Cary Grant, and Jimmy Stewart, and Burt Lancaster, too. She appeared in Airport in an uncredited role. And it was after completing a small part in that latter movie, Airport, that she met a casting agent through a mutual friend who told her that she was casting for a new sitcom pilot for ABC called A New Kind of Family that was being produced by a young man named Gary Marshall, and said she would be perfect for the role of the mother. So the pilot was shot, but was not picked up by ABC. Instead, became an episode on the ABC anthology comedy series Love American Style back in 1972. Now, 2 years later, as a result of the pilot's popularity on Love American Style, ABC finally picked up the pilot when it debuted in January 1974 under the title Happy Days. Now, although Marion uses the first half of her book to tell her story in a very introspective, revealing, and philosophical tone, she allows ghostwriter David Laurel to allow the people she is close with both personally and professionally to give their point of view of who and what Marion Ross is all about. And telling their sides of the story in the book are her real-life children, her personal assistant, Gwen Barron, and her Happy Days family, including Ron Howard, Henry Winkler, Anson Williams, Don Most, and the late Aaron Moran and late Gary Marshall. Now, this device I found worked quite well as it helps to complete the well-rounded portrait of Marion Ross, which is a combination of a complex, strong individual who faced and conquered adversity because she had a very difficult marriage, and the co-star who was just as much a mother figure to her TV family as off-screen as she was on-screen.
And I'm guessing that it would be a slightly different chapter if they had the chance to talk to the late Tom Bosley, because I understand they didn't get along too well.
Yes, that's right. At the offset, they didn't. Until Marion found out that he was under pressure and under some stress because his wife was dying of cancer. And once, unfortunately, she did pass away. But after that, the relationship between the two of them improved quite dramatically.
Well, to hear her tell it to me when I spoke to her, she mentioned the fact that, you know, as far as stars were concerned, people knew who Ron Howard was from his previous days working in the Andy Griffith Show, but to the rest of the cast, most of them were unknown. And here's a guy who had won a Tony Award for playing LaGuardia on Broadway, so he was the star. And he kind of thought that Marion Ross was, quite frankly, beneath his talent.
Yeah, that's right. I think that was sort of like that inferior, superior kind of thing, dynamic, that sort of like created tensions between them, when the show started filming.
When I spoke to her, she mentioned that they really didn't become, they didn't get past their animosity for each other, or at least his for her, until after the fourth season. Could you imagine working with somebody? Well, actually, I can. But can you imagine working for 4 years with someone you don't like? Or who doesn't like you? That's, wow.
Well, maybe that's what happens when your show becomes a hit. And also, how can I say? Also, those softball, that softball team, the traveling softball games they did, helped a lot to create more, camaraderie between the cast members, too.
Actually, she did mention that was a very big thing to patching up and making that that cast and crew a family.
And that was
a Gary Marshall thing.
Yeah, and Gary Marshall was quite the character himself. But she even mentioned to me, and also in the book, that the day after they filmed the very last episode, you know, you think they all go their separate ways. No, they didn't. They just picked up and the whole cast and crew. The softball team did a tour of Asia and played, with at a Marine base. It just the day after they filmed the last episode.
Wow.
Yeah, quite incredible, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I mean, and also these days, Marion is happily retired. She lives on her Happy Days farm in California. And her neighbor is Scott Baio. Chachi is her neighbor.
Wow.
Although Marion was... admit she was first reluctant to write this book, I think classic TV fans are going to be grateful that Marion Ross decided to forgo her reluctance to write My Days Happy and Otherwise. And she admitted to me that now she has a marvelous experience. She had a marvelous experience writing the memoir that wasn't exactly a scandal-filled tell-all. And I think her many fans and admirers should be satisfied that they got a memoir that's filled with genuine honesty and affection, not to mention cherished memories of one of TV's most popular and longest-running sitcoms from the point of view of one of TV's most popular moms.
And the book is?
It's called My Days, Happy and Otherwise by Marion Ross. It's published by Kensington Books, and it's $28.95.
And what other books in that similar genre do you recommend?
Well, I recommend three, two of them by the late Gary Marshall. He did a two-part memoir. One was called My Happy Days in Hollywood, and one before that is called Wake Me When It's Funny, How to Break Into Showbiz and Stay There. So I recommend those two, very anecdote-filled, fun books to read. And on the TV mom side of it, read the memoir by Shirley Jones, Shirley Partridge herself. It's called simply Shirley Jones, a memoir. A lot of great behind-the-scenes stories about working on the Partridge Family, working with, on the Broadway stage, working with Burt Lancaster and Elmer Gantry, winning the Oscar. And also her, her marriage to Jack Cassidy, where sometimes I think there was a little too much information divulged in the book. But then again, why do they call it tell-all memoir? Because you tell all.
Right.
And there you go.
And again, this week's book is?
It's called My Days, Happy and Otherwise by Marion Ross. It's published by Kensington Books, and it's $28.95.
And how can people find you?
Well, they won't find me at Arnold's eating some Arnold burgers. They'll find me in the pages of the Montreal Times. That's where. Every Saturday in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Stuart.
Well, you're welcome, Peter. And Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days.
No, stop singing or we're going to bring back Gordon Lightfoot from a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, no. Well, don't want that to happen, do we?
No. Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming up in just a matter of moments, and I've got another Stuff File news story that I want to share with you before we get to that point. But before we get to that point. Speaking of books, we just spoke to Stuart Nelman with Book Banter. I want to mention one more book. You know which one I'm going to mention. Of course you know which one I'm going to mention. It's my book! It's Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, which I really, 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 really would like you to purchase. Like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and the ever-popular much, much more, plus two guys who left their footprints up on the moon. You can't get further than that to leave footprints, pal. Anyway, check it out. It's available at Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website, which is BearManorMedia.com. And you'll also find the links to the book on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So go ahead, buy the book! What are you waiting for, huh? What are you waiting for? Anyway, getting right back to the stuff, 67-year-old Timothy Hill of Grassington, North Yorkshire, England, having installed a laser jammer in his Range Rover, thought he was outsmarting law enforcement speed cameras. In fact, he was so sure of his scheme that he repeatedly raised his middle finger to the cameras, sometimes casually, sometimes aggressively, as he passed by. What he didn't realize was that the laser jammer, rather than hiding his identity, was only blocking police from determining his speed. So, when they tracked him down, he was charged not with speeding, but with perverting the course of justice. Said traffic constable Andrew Forth, "If you want to attract our attention, repeatedly gesturing at police camera vans with your middle finger while you're driving a distinctive car fitted with a laser jammer is an excellent way to do it." Hill pleaded guilty on April 23rd and was sentenced to 8 months in jail and prohibited from driving for a year. You know, in some countries, they would have taken away not only his freedom and his right to drive, but also his middle finger. That's the joy of living in a free society. You know, I was seriously thinking about making him the idiot of the day, but I did not. But we are at that juncture of the program, boys and girls. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff file presents the idiot of the day.
24-year-old Kiana Wallace was sentenced to 18 months in prison in Belmont County, Ohio on April 23rd, following her guilty plea for tampering with evidence. On probation after a drug possession sentence in 2017, Wallace failed a drug urine test when the borrowed sample she used tested positive for drugs. "Let me get this straight," said Judge Frank Fragiato in the court. "To avoid a positive test with your own urine, you used someone else's urine, which turned out to be positive also. That's bizarre." Yeah. Couldn't say it better myself, Judge. Because why, oh why, would you use someone else's drug-tainted pee to replace your own drug-tainted pee? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0455. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0455. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep environmental thought. If we don't do something about global warming soon, eventually there won't be any ice floes left to put our elders on.